The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Cynthia Schemmer, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Tommy Orange's debut novel, There, There, weaves together the stories of 12 characters from Native communities in Oakland, California, who are connected through centuries of abuse, challenges in identity, survival, and the meaning of home. Through Orange's poignant and absorbing artistry, the experiences coalesce into the plight of the urban Native American. There, There was a 2019 Pulitzer Prize finalist, winner of the 2018 National Book Critics Circle Awards John Leonard Prize, winner of the 2019 Hemingway Foundation Pen Award, and is a New York Times bestseller. Born and raised in Oakland, Orange is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma and teaches in the MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts. Two-time National Book Award finalist Rachel Kushner is the author of Telex from Cuba, The Flamethrowers, and The Mars Room, a finalist for the Man Booker Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. As described by the New York Times, The Flamethrowers was in love with speed and with anarchy, with moments during a strike, an urban riot, a New York City blackout, when the rules are suspended and everything is up for grabs. The Mars Room, on the other hand, shapes against the slowness and sameness of time and the oppressiveness of a system that, in the name of justice, dooms our poorest citizens to lives of incarceration. Kushner's fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, and The Paris Review, and she was the recipient of a 2013 Guggenheim Fellowship. And now, please give a warm welcome to our first author, Tommy Orange.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out. I am going to read something I don't usually read. I'm going to read in a whole chapter of something. This is from a chapter called Edwin Black. Edwin Black. I'm on the toilet, but nothing is happening. I'm here. You have to try. You have to intend. And not only tell yourself, but really sit there believing. It's been 6 days since my last movement. One of the bullet point symptoms on WebMD was this, the sense that everything didn't come out. This feels true about my life in ways I can't articulate yet. Or like the name of a short story collection I'll write one day, when it all finally does come out. The trouble with believing is that you have to believe that believing will work. You have to believe in belief. I've scraped out the little bowl of faith I keep by the open window my mind has become ever since the internet got inside it, made me a part of it. I'm not joking. I feel as if I'm going through withdrawal. I've read about residential internet rehab facilities in Pennsylvania. They have digital detox retreats and underground desert compounds in Arizona. My problem hasn't just been with gaming or gambling or incessantly scrolling down and refreshing my social media pages or the endless search to find good new music. It's all of it. I was really into Second Life for a while. I think I logged 2 whole years there. And as I was growing, getting fatter in real life, the Edwin Black I had in there, on there, I made him thinner. And as I did less, he did more. The Edwin Black in there had a job and a girlfriend, and his mom had died tragically during childbirth. That Edwin Black was raised on the reservation with his dad. The Edwin Black of my second life was proud. He had hope. This Edwin Black, me here on the toilet, can't get there on the internet because yesterday I dropped my phone in the toilet and my computer froze. Same fucking day, it just stopped. and even the mouse cursor moved. Not even the mouse cursor moved. No spinning wheels of promised load. No reboot after unplug. Just a sudden and mute black screen, my face reflected in it, staring first in horror at the computer dying, then at my face reacting to seeing my face react to the computer dying. A little part of me died then, seeing my face, thinking about this sick addiction, all the time I've spent doing almost nothing. 4 years of sitting, staring into my computer at the internet. I guess if you don't count sleep, it's three, if you don't count the dreaming. But I dream of the internet, of keyword search phrases that make complete sense in the dream, are the key to the dream's meaning, but which make no sense in the morning, like all the dreams I've ever had. I once dreamed I'd become a writer, which is to say I graduated with my master's in comparative literature with a focus on Native American literature. It certainly must have looked like I was on my way towards something, with my degree in hand, and the last picture I'd posted to Facebook. The picture is of me in my cap and gown, 100 pounds lighter, my mom with a too wide smile, looking at me with untethered adoration when she should have been looking at Bill, her boyfriend, who I'd told her not to bring, and who insisted on taking pictures of us when I asked him not to. I did end up liking that picture. I've looked at it more than I have any other picture of myself. It stayed as my profile pic until recently, because a few months, even a year, was fine, not abnormal. But after 4 years, it was the socially unacceptable kind of sad. When I moved back in with my mom, the door to my old room, to my old life, in that room, it opened up like a mouth and swallowed me. Now I don't have any dreams, or if I dream, I dream of dark geometric shapes drifting noiselessly across a pink, black, and purple pixelated colorscape. Screensaver dreams. I have to give up. Nothing's coming. I stand up, pull my pants up, and walk out of the bathroom defeated. My stomach is a bowling ball. I don't believe it at first. I do a double take. My computer. I almost jump at the sight of it coming back to life. I almost clap. I'm embarrassed at my excitement. I thought for sure it was a virus. I'd clicked a link to download the Lone Ranger. Everyone agreed on how bad it was, in so many ways, but I was excited to see it. There's something about seeing Johnny Depp fail so badly that gives me strength. I sit down and wait for my computer to come all the way on. I find that I'm rubbing my hands together and stop myself, put my hands in my lap. I look up at a picture I have taped on my wall. It's Homer Simpson in front of a microwave wondering, could Jesus microwave a burrito so hot he himself couldn't eat it? I think about the irresistible force paradox, how there cannot be both an irresistible force and an immovable object in existence at once. But what is happening in my blocked, coiled, possibly knotted bowels? Could it be the working out of an ancient paradox? If shitting mysteriously stopped, and couldn't seeing, hearing, breathing do so in turn? No. It's all the shitty food. Paradoxes don't work out. They cancel out. I'm overthinking it. I want it too much. Sometimes the internet can think with you, or even for you, lead you in mysterious ways to information you need and would never have thought to think of or research on your own. This is how I found out about bezoars. A bezoar is a mass found trapped in the gastrointestinal system. But when you search bezoar, you're led to the Picatrix. The Picatrix is a book of magic and astrology from the 12th century, originally written in Arabic and titled Gayat al-Hakim, meaning the goal of the wise. Bezoars have all kinds of uses in the Picatrix, one of which is to make talismans that aid in certain kinds of magic. I was able to find a PDF of the English translation of the Picatrix. When I scrolled down to an arbitrary place in the document, the word laxative caught my eye, and I read the following passage. The Indians indicate that when the moon is at this position, they travel and use laxative medicines. Thus you may use this as a principle in making a talisman for a traveler in his safety. Also, when the moon is at this position, a talisman can be made to create discord and animosity between spouses. If I even remotely believed in any kind of magic aside from the kind that led me to this very entry, and if I could somehow surgically remove the bezoar, I would make it into a talisman, granted the moon was in the corresponding position, and take care of my constipation while also possibly destroying my mom and Bill's relationship. Bill's not an asshole. If anything, he goes out of his way to be nice, to make conversation with me. It's the forced nature of it, that I have to decide whether to treat him well or not, this stranger. My mom and Bill met at a bar in downtown Oakland. My mom brought him home, let him return again and again for the past 2 years, and I was forced to have to think about how or if I should like or not like the guy, get to know him or try to get rid of him. But then I struggle with resisting Bill because I don't want to be some creepy man baby jealous of my mom's boyfriend because I want her all to myself. Bill's a Lakota guy who grew up in Oakland. He's over almost every night. Whenever he's over, I stay in my room, and I can neither shit nor not shit. So I hoard food and stay in my room, read about what I can do about this possible new phase of constipation. What I just found out on a constipation forum thread might be obstipation, which is severe or complete constipation. The end. Forum member Defecate Moss said that not shitting could kill you, and that she once had to have a tube stuck down her nose to have it sucked out. She said if you start feeling nauseous and have abdominal pain, you should go to the emergency room. I feel nauseous thinking about the idea of shitting out of my nose through a tube. I type the brain and constipation and hit enter. I click on several links, scroll through several pages. I read a lot and come away with nothing. This is how time skips. Links just lead to links that can lead you all the way back to the 12th century. This is how it can all of a sudden be 6 a.m. with my mom knocking on the door before she goes to work at the Indian Center, or she keeps trying to get me to apply for a job. I know you're still awake, she says. I can hear you clicking in there. Lately, I've become a little obsessed with the brain, with trying to find explanations for everything as it relates to the brain and its parts. There's almost too much information out there. The internet is like a brain trying to figure out a brain. I depend on the internet for recall now. There's no reason to remember when it's always just right there, like the way everyone used to know phone numbers by heart and now can't even remember their own. Remembering itself is becoming old-fashioned. The hippocampus is the part of the brain connected to memory, but I can't remember exactly what that means. Is memory stored there, or is the hippocampus like the limbs of memory that reach into other parts of the brain where it's actually stored in little nodes or folds or pockets? And isn't it always reaching, bringing up memories, the past, without being asked? Typing in the search bar before I can even think to do it? Before I can think, I am thinking with it? I find out the same neurotransmitter related to happiness and well-being supposedly has to do with your gastrointestinal system. There's something wrong with my serotonin levels. I read about selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are antidepressants. Would I have to take antidepressants? Or would I have to re-uptake them? I stand up and back away from the computer, put my head all the way back to stretch my neck. I try to calculate how long I've been at the computer, but when I shove a 2-day-old piece of pizza in my mouth, my thoughts move toward what is happening to me in my brain while I eat. I chew and click another link. I read that the brain stem is the basis of consciousness, and that the tongue correlates with the brain stem almost directly. And so eating is the most direct path to getting the feeling that you're alive. This feeling or thought is interrupted by a craving for Pepsi. While I pour Pepsi into my mouth straight from the bottle, I look at myself in the mirror my mom put on the front of the fridge. Had she done it in order to make me see myself before going into the fridge? Was she saying by putting that mirror there, look at yourself, Ed. Look at what you've become. You're a monster. But it's true, I'm swollen. I see my cheeks at all times, like a big nose person always sort of sees their nose. I spit the Pepsi out into the sink behind me. I touch my cheeks with both hands. I touch the reflection of my cheeks with both hands, then suck my cheeks in, bite them to preview what it might look like if I lost 30 pounds. I hadn't grown up fat, not overweight, not obese, or plus size, or whatever you can call it now without sounding politically incorrect or insensitive or unscientific. But I always felt fat. Did that somehow mean I was destined to one day be fat? Or did my obsession with being fat, even when I wasn't, lead to me eventually being fat? Does what we try to most avoid come after us because we pay too much attention to it with our worry? I hear the Facebook pop ding sound from my computer and go back in my room. I know what it could mean. I'm still logged in to my mom's Facebook account. All my mom remembered about my dad was his first name, Harvey, that he lived in Phoenix and that he was a Native American Indian. I've always hated when she says Native American Indian, this weird politically correct catch-all you only hear from white people who've never known a real Native person. And it reminds me of how removed I am because of her, not only because she is white and me therefore half white, but because of how she never did a single thing to try to connect me with my dad. I use Native, that's what other Native people on Facebook use. I have 660 friends, tons of Native friends in my feed. Most of my friends, though, are people I don't know, who'd happily friended me upon request. After getting permission from my mom, I personally messaged 10 different Harveys from her profile who seemed obviously Native and lived in Phoenix. "You may not remember me," I wrote. "We had a special night together some years ago. I can't shake the memory of it. There were none like you before or since. I'm in Oakland, California now. Are you still in Phoenix? Can we talk? Meet up sometime, maybe? Will you be out here? I could come to you." I'll never fully recover from the feeling of trying to write as my own mother in an alluring way to my possible father. But here it is, a message from my possible dad. "Hey there, Karen, I do remember that wild night," I read with horror. Hoping there would be zero details about what made the night wild. "I'm coming out to Oakland in a couple months for the big Oakland powwow. I'm the powwow MC," the message reads. Heart racing, a sick falling feeling in my stomach, I type back, "I'm so sorry to have done this, like this. I think I'm your son." I wait, tap my foot, stare at the screen, clear my throat pointlessly. I imagine how he must be feeling, to go from hooking up with an old fling to having a son out of nowhere. I shouldn't have done it like that. I should have had my mom meet him. I could have had her take a picture. "What?" pops up in the chat window. "This isn't Karen. I don't understand. I'm Karen's son." "Oh, yeah. You're telling me I have a son and it's you?" "Yeah." "Are you sure?" "My mom said it's more than likely, like 99%. "No other guys during that same time period then, huh?" "I don't know." "Sorry, is she around?" "No." "You look Indian?" "My skin is brown-ish." "Is this about money?" "No." "You don't have a profile pic." "Neither do you." I see a paperclip icon with a JPEG extension. I double-click it. He's standing there with a microphone in his hand. Powwow dancers in the background. I see myself in the man's face. He's bigger than me, both taller and fatter, with long hair wearing a baseball cap, but there's no mistaking it. It's my dad. "You look like me," I type. "Send me a picture." "I don't have one." "Take one." "Fine, hold on." I type, then take a selfie with my computer's camera and send it to him. "Well, shit," Harvey writes. "Well, shit," I think. "What tribe are you / we?" I write. "Cheyenne, Southern, out of Oklahoma, enrolled with Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. We're not Arapahos." "Thanks," I type, and then gotta go, as if I do. All of it is suddenly too much for me. I log off of Facebook and go to the living room to watch TV and wait for my mom to come home. I forget to turn the TV on. I stare at the blank black screen, flat screen, think about our conversation. For how many years had I been dying to find out what the other half of me was? How many tribes had I made up when asked in the meantime? I'd gotten through 4 years as a Native American studies major, dissecting tribal histories, looking for signs, something that might resemble me, something that felt familiar. I made it through 2 years of grad school studying comparative literature with an emphasis on Native American literature. I wrote my thesis on the inevitable influence of blood quantum policies on modern Native identity and the literature written by mixed blood Native authors that influenced identity in Native cultures, all without knowing my tribe, always defending myself like I'm not Native enough. I'm as Native as Obama is black. It's different, though, for Natives. I know. I don't know how to be. Every possible way I think that it might look for me to say I'm Native seems wrong. "Hey, Ed, what are you doing out here?" my mom says as she walks through the front door. "I thought you'd merged with the machines by now," she says, and puts her hands up and sort of twiddles her fingers in a mocking way as she says, "merged with the machines." I'd recently made the mistake of telling her about singularity, about how it was an eventuality, an inevitability that we'd end up merging with artificial intelligence. Once we saw that it was superior, once it asserted itself as superior, we would need to adapt to merge so as not to be swallowed, taken over. Well, that's a pretty convenient theory for someone who spends 20 hours a day leaning into their computer like they're waiting for a kiss, she said. She throws her keys on the table, keeps the front door open, lights a cigarette, and smokes there in the doorway, pointing her mouth and the smoke out the door. "Come over here for a second, I want to talk." "Mom," I say, and I tone I know is a whine. "Edwin," she says, mocking my tone. We talked about this. I want updates. You agreed to updates. Otherwise, another 4 years are going to go by, and I'm going to have to ask Bill to knock down a wall for you back there." "Fuck Bill," I say. "I told you I don't want to hear anything from you about my weight. I'm aware of it. You think I don't know about it? I'm aware of the fact that I'm huge. I walk around with it. It knocks things over. I can't fit into most of my clothes. What I can fit into makes me look ridiculous. Without my meaning to, my arms are waving in the air like I'm trying to fit them into one of my shirts that don't fit anymore. I bring them down, shove my hands into my pockets. I haven't shit in 6 days. Do you know what that feels like for an already big person? Being big, you think about it all the time. You feel it. All those years dieting all the time, you don't think that fucked me up? We're always thinking about our weight. Are we too fat? Well, what I have going on comes with an easy answer, and even more so when I see my reflection in the mirror on the front of the fridge, which, by the way, I know you put there for my benefit. You know, when you try to make jokes about it, it makes me want to get fatter, blow up, keep eating until I get stuck somewhere, die somewhere, just this huge dead mass. They'll have to get a crane to get me out. And everyone will be saying to you, "What happened? And poor thing. And how could you have let this happen?" And you'll be there desperately smoking a cigarette, dumbfounded. Bill behind you, rubbing your shoulders. And you'll remember all the times you made fun of me, and you won't know what to tell the neighbors. Who'll be staring in horror at my mass, the crane just shuddering, doing its best. I simulate a shuddering crane with my hand for her. "Jesus, Ed, that's enough. Come talk to me for a second." I pick up a green apple from the fruit basket and pour myself a glass of water. "See," I almost shout, holding up the apple for her to see. "I'm trying. Here's a live update for you. I'm live streaming it to you right now. Look, I'm trying to eat better. I just spit out some Pepsi in the sink. This is a glass of water." "I wish you would calm down," my mom says. "You're gonna have a heart attack. Relax. Treat me like I'm your mother, like I care about you, like I love you. Treat me like I went through 26 hours of labor for you. 26 hours and then a cesarean section on top of it. They had to slice me open, Ed. You didn't want to come out. You were 2 weeks late. Did I ever tell you that? You want to talk about feeling full?" I wish you would stop throwing it in my face how many hours of labor you went through to get me here. I didn't ask to come. Throwing it in your face? You think I throw it in your face? She runs over to me and tickles me behind the neck. To my horror, I can't help but laugh. "Stop, okay, just you calm down. What do you want to hear?" I say, and pull my shirt down over my belly. "I don't have any updates. There's not much out there for someone with virtually no work experience with an MA in comp lit. I look, I scour, I get frustrated, and sure, I get distracted. There's so much to look up, and then when you think of something new, when you discover something new, it's like you're thinking with another mind, like you have access to a bigger collective brain, We're on the edge of something here, I say, knowing how it must sound to her. You're on the edge of something, all right. Collective brain? Scour? You make it sound like you're doing a lot more than clicking links and reading. But okay, so like, what kind of job are you looking for? I mean, what categories do you look under? I look under writing gigs, and that's almost always some kind of scam designed for naive aspiring writers looking for work, looking to work for free or to win a contest. I look under arts organizations, then I get lost in the nonprofit morass, grant writing stuff, and you know, most places require experience or grant writing? You could do that, couldn't you? I know nothing about grant writing. You could learn, research. There's probably YouTube tutorials or something, right? Those are my updates, I say, and feel a pull from a limb gone loose. While I was talking, something in me reached back to remember all that I'd once hoped I'd be and placed it next to the feeling of being who I am now. I'm sorry I'm such a fuck-up, I say, and I don't want to, but I really mean it. Don't talk like that. You're not a loser, Ed. I didn't say I was a loser, Bill said. Bill says that. That's Bill's word for me, I say. And whatever true sadness I felt is gone. I turn to go back to my room. Just wait. Don't go back to your room. Please, wait a second. Sit down. Let's talk. This isn't talking. I've been sitting down all day. And whose fault is that? She says. And I start to walk toward my room. Okay, stand, but stay. We don't have to talk about Bill. How are your stories coming along then, sweetie? My stories? Come on, Mom. What? Whenever we talk about my writing, I feel like you're trying to make me feel better about the fact that I'm even doing it. Ed, we can all use encouragement. All of us. Back in my room, I put my earphones in, put on A Tribe Called Red. They're a group of First Nations DJs and producers based out of Ottawa. They make electronic music with samples from powwow drum groups. It's the most modern and most postmodern form of Indigenous music I've heard that's both traditional and new sounding. The problem with Indigenous art in general is that it's stuck in the past. The catch or the double bind about the whole thing is, if it isn't pulling from tradition, how is it Indigenous? And if it's stuck in tradition in the past, how can it be relevant to other Indigenous people living now? How can it be modern? So to get close to, but keep enough distance from tradition in order to be recognizably native and modern sounding is a small kind of miracle these three First Nations producers made happen on a particularly accessible self-titled album, which they, in the spirit of the mixtape, gave away for free online. I settle myself on the floor and weekly attempt some push-ups. I roll over and try a sit-up. My top half won't budge. I think about my college days, about how long ago that was and how hopeful I'd been, how impossible my current life would have seemed to me then. I'm not used to pushing my body to do anything. Maybe it's too late to come back from what I've done to myself. No. Being finished looks like sitting back down at the computer. I'm not finished. I am a Cheyenne Indian, a warrior. No, that's super corny. I get mad at that thought, that I even thought it. I use the anger to push, to do a sit-up. I push my hardest and rise. I get all the way up, but with the exhilaration of completing my first sit-up comes an explosion, a wet, smelly lump of relief in the seat of my sweatpants. I'm out of breath, sweating, sitting in my own shit. I lie back down, put both of my arms out flat, palms up. I find myself saying thank you out loud to no one in particular. I feel something not unlike hope. Thank you.
That was great. Hi. I'm just going to share with you all really quickly that I was leaving my hotel to get here, and my neighbors in the hotel like hotboxed me with their dope smoke. And I feel a little confused. And then, does everybody notice that it's cool to be here. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Philadelphia it's grand and historic, but did you guys notice that Bell has a big-ass crack in it? Does everybody point that out? All right. I'm just going to read a few different scenes from my book. Okay. This book takes place in the early 2000s in California. They gave us one size fits all polka dot muumuus and three size fits most canvas slippers. Even big and burly Conan was forced to wear a muumuu. He threw his shoulders back to show the cops the muumuu was too small. I need pants and a shirt. I can't wear this. It ain't right, Sarge. He kept raising his arms. It's too tight in the shoulders. Lieutenant Jones said, "What are you planning to do in it, ma'am? Conduct an orchestra? Shut up and put your arms down." The prison muumuus made me think of that expression, lipstick on a pig. No woman should be compared to a pig, nor made to wear the garment they gave us, and no Conan either. Conan is a trans man, and it's a women's prison. We were chained to a bench in a hall, waiting to be interviewed in a little concrete room about drug use, sexual history, mental health, and whether or not we had gang affiliations or enemies currently serving time at Stanville. After several hours of this, they gave us each a bedroll and a CDC offender's handbook, as well as a 40-page guide to the CDC offender's handbook. Conan wondered out loud if we would also be getting a guide to the handbook. "The failure to report a rule violation," Conan said in a nasal voice, "is also a rule violation. The failure to report a rule violation of a failure to report a rule violation is another rule violation." Lieutenant Jones said, "Not even 6 hours in prison, London, and you just earn your first 115. I figured she was being sarcastic, but she went over to the cop shop and started writing him up. Some of the girls laughed and snickered that Conan was getting written up. You'd think we would band together. Even our ragtag crew from the bus, with all 60 of us, we could have subdued the two transport cops easily enough, hijacked that vehicle, and gone to Mexico. But there was no cooperation, just people eager to see others fall under the hammer they suffered under themselves." Jones began deciphering for us loudly the signs in the day room, since we were all presumed dyslexic or presumed illiterate. The signs began the same way. "Ladies, report to staff if you have a staff infection. Ladies, no whining. Ladies, out of bounds results in an automatic 115. The warning shot sign was more blunt. "No warning shots in this area." Jones read the guide to the handbook, and then the handbook itself. There were rules about everything: appearance and thoughts and letters and language, food and attitude and scheduling, tools and implements and use. Many instructions on who not to touch, anyone, or where, nowhere, and certainly no fornication was allowed. "What is fornication again?" Conan asked. "It's just fucking, right?" The clock on the wall had a red wedge from 5 minutes to the hour until 5 minutes past the hour. This was for the women who could not tell time. Jones explained the red wedge. "All you need to know," she said, "is that when the big hand is on red, room doors are on unlock." Everything in prison is addressed to the woman for whom the red wedge is painted on the clock face, the imbecile. I've never met her. Plenty I have met in prison cannot read, and some cannot tell time, but that doesn't mean they are not shrewd and superior individuals who can outsmart any egghead. The imbecile the rules and signs are meant to address is nowhere to be found. And then just move ahead a little. Our once weekly yard time was not a real yard, just the administrative segregation yard. a small concrete area wrapped in razor wire. But we got to see Conan out there on his, see, I know I'm stoned because I'm just hearing this beeping noise. We got to see Conan out there on his own adjacent razor wire concrete patch. Conan did push-ups and talked to me about cars. It had started when Conan asked where I was from. Frisco, huh, he said, where they were doing that extended axle thing back in the 90s. Pokers. Man, you guys have something to answer to. To say Frisco is as goofy and wrong as an extended axle, but Conan was right. It was as if one morning I'd woken to discover that every neighbor on my block had extended their axles so that the wheels of the cars stuck out on both sides. Now it was a distant memory, something unfashionable. Conan and I reminisced about big rims, floater rims, spinners, neon undercar kits, Holley carbs and Hemis, popular trucks and SUVs, the Chevrolet Intruder, the Dodge Rendition. The Intruder, Conan and I agreed, looked like something that was designed to be inserted in something else. There's a new Nissan coming out called the Cube, Conan said. You can only get it in Japan. But who wants a square car? The Cube. Now there's an aerodynamic concept. Nissan makes these trucks you can hacksaw the catalytic converter off in 3 minutes. I can't walk past one without stealing the muffler. I should sue the manufacturer for forcing criminal behavior on me. We laughed about the smart car. Those look to me like the cap on a furniture leg, a blunt vertical thing that scooted around. What did you drive? Conan asked me. A 63 Impala, I said. Dang. Hell yeah, Sammy said. That's my girl. But the moment I said it, the fun cracked to pieces. I had no car anymore. You know what I hate is when people put open headers on an Escalade, Conan said, as I tried to steer my thoughts back, to listen, to not care about anything. Fuck Escalades. Something about them is plastic, cheap. I'd take an Eldorado, though. The 70s is the end of good American cars. We used to make trucks in this country. Now, we make truck nuts. Wow, no one laughed. Those ugly things dangling over the road at 80 miles an hour, I didn't know they were called that. The idea that men would want to display an artificial scrotum, the most fragile part of a man's body, on the back of their trucks, I said it made no sense, and Conan agreed. Where is the pride in towing those from a bumper? If I was an actual dude, I'd tow a big-ass trailer with a Harley on it, Conan said, or I'd just ride a Harley. I heard you bragging to Sergeant McKinley that you do ride a Harley, I said. That's what I mean. If I was a dude, I'd be like I am right now, except not locked up. Sammy told us she'd owned a Trans Am at age 15. Her dealer and boyfriend, Smokey, had given it to her. I know a Smokey, Conan said. I did too, not personally. The Smokey I knew of was Smokey Unick, the NASCAR builder. Smokey Unick was someone Jimmy Darling and I had bonded over. Smokey Unick cheated in all of his NASCAR innovations, but everyone else did too. Also, when he was a young stock car racer, he raced with one arm out the window, resting on the sill. Smokey Unick had swagger, but Smokey Unick was dead. I was in prison. Jimmy was wherever. With some other woman, no doubt. And whoever the other woman was reminded me of what I was not, was no longer. Conan said, "It ain't Smokey from Bell Gardens you're talking about, is it?" It was. Sammy said. Smokey was your boyfriend? I'm from Bell Gardens, and the Smokey I know is a she. I didn't know that when I met him, Sammy said. This fine-ass guy wearing, what are they called, the little white shells around his neck, shows up, and we're partying. He's got a bottle of PCP, and the next thing I know, I'm in a motel in Whittier, and it's 2 days later. puka shells, Sergeant McKinley said over the PA. He was in the program office behind one-way glass, listening to our conversation with long-range microphones. I wake up with no memory of how I got there. I'm covered in hickeys, and this person, Smokey, is sleeping next to me. We're both like, we don't have our clothes on. I peek under the sheet, and he was the same as me down there. I was shocked. We were together for 2 years after that. Smokey could hotwire any vehicle. She would steal a car, we'd party in it, wipe off the prints, and dump it. Once, they were in a fight, and Sammy was trying to buy heroin at the hamburger stand in Compton. Smokey came revving up in this horribly loud cement truck, the mixer on the back revolving full tilt. Sammy yelled over the grinding noise for Smokey to shut it off. I could not score with a cement mixer next to me, so I start walking away to lose her and that noisy thing, and Smokey's driving at the speed of my walking. No dealer was going to sell to me creating a scene like that. I'm yelling, turn it off, the what's it called, the spinning thing, and she's going, I don't know how. All she could do was put it in gear and drive it. We were yelling at each other, and finally I got in so we could fight in private. We go driving around in this cement mixer, and we're starting to get along. I'm not mad anymore. The driver had left his lunchbox on the seat. I opened it thinking I'd drink his juice, eat his sandwich, whatever he had in there, and inside the lunchbox is the dude's wallet. Smokey and I got in a fight all over again. She had this crack idea that because she hotwired the cement mixer, the wallet was hers. Nuh-uh, sorry. I took the cash and got out. Our relationship had a lot of drama to it like that. Different ideas on things. All right. Just read one last little section. Sammy, Conan, and I all got assigned to the wood shop, which was hiring at 22 cents an hour, good money. Conan bragged that with his wages, he was going to invest in a tattoo rig, start a side business, and do some art on himself. We were sitting in the common area, waiting for the Friday night movie to begin. They were delayed because the film that was scheduled had profanity. They had to swap it out for Driving Miss Daisy, which they'd shown us the Friday before. What tattoo do you want? Sammy asked Conan. A big-ass portrait of Saddam Hussein, Conan said, tacked up right here. He bulged his bicep, just to piss off these dickwads. Two unit cops were trying to work the film projector. Support our troops, Conan yelled. Shut the fuck up, someone else yelled. The movie was starting. On our first day in woodshop, the prison industry supervisor told us we were going to get excellent on-the-job training skills, which would translate into employment upon our release. What about those who don't have a release date? Teardrop asked. Normally, you can't work in prison industries, he said. We can't use you because you don't need the training since you're not getting out. And this is all about training people to work jobs. But right now, we've got a ton of orders to fill, so you've found yourself in a lucky position. You're going to learn to build furniture here, and I can tell you ladies that a finished carpenter makes great money. Conan was impressed with the shop. Dang, we get to use real wood, table saws, miter boxes. At Wasco, the wood shop isn't even real. The wood there is all compressed particle board. You glue these pieces together. That's your only tool, glue. You can't even drive in a nail or that stuff will split and crumble. We weren't learning anything there. I told the supervisor, you keep talking about finished carpentry and we don't make stuff that will teach us it. He goes, that's because you people are animals and if we give you tools, you'll kill each other. I ask him, so what are we here to learn? And he goes, you're here to learn how to work, to show up on time, to become workers, as if that's a thing. We didn't learn anything at the Wasco woodshop. We huffed glue all day. Then they came up with this huff-free glue. No Huff, it was called. That was its name, No Huff Glue. You can't huff it. It doesn't do anything. No power tools, no learning curve, no drug high. It was better than the other prison industries, though. The outfit down the hall, those dudes were making safety goggles for prison industries. And next to that building, they made boots for prison industries. On the wall above us in the wood shop were brochures with pictures of the furniture proudly manufactured by inmates at Stanville Prison Industries woodworking facility. This is what we made. Judges' benches, jury box seating, courtroom gates, witness stands, lecterns, judges' gavels, paneling for judges' quarters, wooden courtroom cages for in-custody defendants, wood frames for the state seal that goes in the judges' chambers, and judges' seats, which then went to upholstery next door. Not among the state merchandise we built, someone, sometime, had crafted a child's desk, like you see in schools, with a hinge so the top can open to store supplies inside. It had a small matching chair. The desk and chair were at the entrance to the wood shop. "That little desk makes me sad," Conan said. I trained myself not to look at it. Thank you.
Rachel, Tommy, thank you so much for those readings. Hi, everyone. The way this works, and I'm sure most of you know, you raise your hand, we'll get a microphone to you. We've got about 10, 15 minutes, so we'll try to get as many questions in as possible, so please make them direct and brief. Who would like to start us off?
Hi, thank you both. I loved both your books. My question is for Tommy. What is the significance of the spider legs that are in your book?
So the spider leg thing was, I pulled two spider legs out of my own leg, and I didn't really know what that was, and I scoured the internet and couldn't find anything, and it seemed sort of Indian to me, so I called my dad, and he told me it sounded like I got witched, and then I was like, well, what do we do? And he was like, I'll pray for you. And I sort of had some ideas in mind around a spider theme for the book, and so I decided I don't know what else to do with it, and I gave it to my characters. So it's not necessarily a lot of symbolism in it, but there are spider themes happening.
Hey, so the cohesion between the two stories seems to be a state of unsettle. Was that your point for both of you as authors? Just not really kind of knowing where you're supposed to be.
Were you in the hotel room next door to me?
No. I'm in my own hotel room all the time. But it just seems to be there's just a sense of just discomfort.
We didn't plan which story, what we didn't know until right before we got on stage what we were reading. So I can't give you a good answer because it just wasn't there.
But do you mean like, does this work?
Yeah,
okay. You mean like the similarity or some overlap between the two excerpts of what we read? Yeah, well, that's really interesting. That's by chance. Well, I just say, I think these books do kind of talk to each other in interesting ways. This is the third event we've done together, so I've heard Tommy speak and I've heard him read now twice. And I know his book because I was on a judging committee that selected it for a prize.
Thank you.
Maybe I can ask you a question. Without talking about the end of the book, did you both write toward the endings that you ultimately use to resolve the stories?
It's the first thing that I knew. The premise was how all these lives converge at a powwow at the Oakland Coliseum. So before this, I thought of it like a year and a half before I even started writing into it. So I knew the basic premise, and I think it helped because it was a lot of lives to juggle and try to figure out how they can feel braided and not knotted. to know that they all need to end up at one place, I think helped in with a sort of complicated novel. It helped me for sure.
My book less so, because you know that the catastrophic event has already occurred before the book even opens, since it's narrated by a woman who just got two life sentences, and I knew that she would go back and be able to expand on her life in the free world, so-called, and her adolescence, but how the book was gonna end, I wasn't sure. I mean, it's not clear in an obvious manner how you can break open a kind of dynamism for someone who's been condemned in that manner. So I didn't know how the book was gonna end, actually, until I was a good three quarters of the way through it. And it was the hardest thing, really, to figure out. And you know, it's just one of those things that you won't, I'm happy with the ending, but I wouldn't have been able to just sketch it out easily. It required just thinking and thinking and thinking until I figured out how she could conceive of her life as something bigger than what the state bureaucracy could name as a life. So, yeah, and then the end, the tone changes completely, and that just happened by necessity, artistic, I mean, like, aesthetic necessity.
Hi, my question is for Tommy. So, in your novel, you have a lot of characters that you cannot, that have different identifiers than yourself, and especially with Blue and Jackie and Opal. How did you go about writing characters that you could not, and experiences that you did not necessarily have, and what was your artistic process in developing and fleshing out those characters like?
Well, I think anytime men are trying to write women, or women are trying to write men, you have to lean pretty hard on the imagination. I grew up kind of in a house of women, and I think that maybe helped through composite experience, and I've known a lot of really strong Native women in my life. And so the aesthetic process was more like, I don't want to make any of them upset at me by not doing it right. And really just like making sure the sentences feel true to the experience as I've seen it. And that's the furthest that I can do, and then leaning on the imagination, like I said.
Can you just speak to that, Rachel, in your characterizations?
Yes. Interestingly, I have a different relationship to it, I think. Like, I mean, maybe it's just a semantical difference, but I mean, everyone you write, you are producing something fictional. So you're not just funneling your experience into characters. It's always synthesized through the process of fiction. But in writing male characters, I don't feel like I have to imagine any more than I do for the female characters. Like, they all require about the same amount of imagination, but maybe that's because for me, fiction is a place where I feel like I go into some much more free and less gendered place. And I don't know if it's because of the conditioning of gender. Like, you learn how to be a woman over the course of your life. And some people figure it out early, for better or worse. Some people figure it out later, for better or worse. Either way, you acquire it, learn it, it becomes you and you it. But when you write, there are parts of you that are very male, or at least what some people call male. But maybe it's simply that gender is much wilder and more broad than we tend to think of it. And that fiction is a place that allows for that to unfold. Like, sometimes you just know things instinctively. And whether it's what it's like to be inside the mind of a person who happens to be male, or the mind of a person who happens to be female, or someone in between, non-binary, less gendered, for me doesn't really make that much of a difference for some reason.
That's fascinating. So do you both find that, do you find something similar, Tommy? And then do you also find that you've got to put coding in so that people know, or are you just following it intuitively?
There's a lot of intuition at play, I think. I think when characters come to me, they come with everything intact in regards to wherever they are on the spectrum of gender. So that always feels pretty clear and instinctual. It doesn't, I don't get too heady about it or try to do too much research. It feels very instinctual for me.
Hello. So as I read there, I thought a lot about forgiveness and healing. And I'm wondering, do you think that it's possible to heal without forgiveness, or is forgiveness a necessary part in that process?
Yeah, I think there has to be a way to heal without forgiveness, because there are too many unforgivable acts that people commit, and I think there'd be something unfair about there not being a way to heal from those things. But it's certainly harder if you can't find a way to forgive somebody for something. It's a lot harder, I think, to find a get to a place of peace or feeling healed. But a lot of that stuff's case-by-case basis, I think. Depends on the act and depends on the person and where is it coming from that you want to forgive them, or what's the reason you can't forgive them, and sort of going from there.
Hi. Both of your books deal with social injustice in different ways. Have you had any feedback that the books have been able to address or to come to some change that you might have wanted to have along the way? I know in Rachel's there are a number of, at the end there's a lot of things about prison reform and things that could be, that might be able to be done, and I imagine that the plight of the urban Native American is also something that, you know, perhaps could be addressed in some way. And then just one quick extra aside, Rachel, do you ride motorcycles?
I did for many years. I don't ride any longer, no. I mean, I have one that's just like a restoration project, but.
Well, for me, I believe art and novels can only do so much, and it has to do with somebody experiencing maybe an enlargening of empathy or coming to understand a people that they may not have or experience that they may not have. That has like, I don't believe that that's gonna change the world. I think it may, there's small changes that fiction can do in people's hearts, and they have to go out there and do the work if it moves them to do so. But I'm certainly not gonna try to say like, these policies need to be changed and A, B, and C needs to happen. Like, I know how to do very little in this world, and I can write, I know that. I don't know how to fix the major problems like what you're referencing.
It's cool to hear your answer and then get it. Yeah, I mean, novels, I don't know if I should admit this or not, but I mean, I've admitted it before, but I'm kind of with Nietzsche that art is truly beyond good and evil. And I don't think of it as a realm for social justice. I mean, that term gets used a lot. And the novel for me is somehow stranger and more irreducible than something that can contain a message, either to repair or reform or heal. Which isn't to say that I don't have my own political commitments in regard to, you know, many types of injustice. But if I had a specific message, I would just say the message instead of write the book, you know? And the book itself can't be reduced to the message, or it's rendered kind of unnecessary. But when I didn't write the book thinking, I know what's wrong with the world and I'm gonna, you know, let other people know. I wrote in a space of real unknowing and embarked on a set of ruminations after asking myself some really rudimentary questions. Like, I would be sitting in a courtroom all day watching arraignments and then ask myself, well, what is the law? And then try to define it as an exercise. The law is a set of rules that is meant to be equally applied to all people. And then what do you do with the fact that people are so profoundly unequal? And it was these kinds of ruminations that I had over, you know, the 5 years it took me to write the book. And I guess I feel like if a reader also asked him or herself those types of questions and ruminated on their own, then I would feel that the book were doing something, you know, positive that I would approve of. But in terms of the real world realm of mass incarceration, I wrote a 10,000 word piece that was in the New York Times Magazine on Easter Sunday that is full of ideas and prescriptions about the future, but mostly of the person I was profiling, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who's dedicated her life and decades of activism to this. But we work together on things, and a lot of my politics are very similar to hers. So for me, that piece is a kind of separate, it's a separate thing from the book, even if there's a little bit of thematic relation between them.
I'm curious as to how interviews each of you had with people that are in your, the characters that are in your book, with real, how interviews with real people that you had informed the characters that are in your books?
Well, for me, I worked in digital storytelling for many years and came to revere people's stories and life experiences as their own, and their it's earned experience. So I make a point of not basing my characters on real people. That feels like bordering on exploitation, if not full-blown exploitation. I recently read that Toni Morrison feels similar about basing fictional characters on people for similar reasons. So while I've done a bunch of work and have had storytelling experience with Native people, I made a point to not base my characters on real people at all, besides myself.
I didn't interview anyone while I was writing this book, so it wasn't like even a possibility. So I'm trying to figure out how to answer despite that. I mean, I work closely with a bunch of different people who are incarcerated, but I work with them on campaigns, or I mentor people with their writing, or I've helped a couple people with their legal cases, people who have not just no representation, but no family, no one on the outside who can help them in any way. You know, people maybe want to have you do photocopies and send, you know, their trial transcript to a lawyer, et cetera. And so I'm involved with things like that with people, but it's really separate from my fiction. And the things they tell me are personal, just like a conversation you would have with a friend. And I wouldn't go and take anything from the conversation and put it in my book, not just because, you know, it is exploitative, as Tommy said, but I don't need to, because there's so much that you can make up. And I think that, like, I love to write dialogue, and dialogue has to have a kind of organic unity to it, so that the story the person is telling, you know, flows within the register of the fiction that you're making, rather than is sort of like sutured in whole cloth from something you were told about. But some of my characters are based on people I knew growing up. I mean, not they aren't based biographically. There's something more like spark or inspiration for me. Like, I had a friend who is nothing like Conan, but who the girls called Conan at my school, and we were very close friends in childhood, and he ended up going to prison, and then he died there. And naming a character after him was a way of paying homage to him, and did not feel disrespectful in the slightest. In fact, it felt like a moral and artistic imperative for me.
Great books, great writers. Please join me in thanking Tommy Arendt and Rachel Kushner.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.